Today we talk about the most celebrated woman in 5th century BC Athens, Aspasia, or Aspasia in ancient Greece. Etymology tells us that her name means the desired one, and although not likely her birth name, we'll see later how this actually fits into her life and her general place in Athens. Now, Aspasia is somebody which we know virtually nothing about, at least in terms of what we can gather from her works, because, well, she didn't write anything. So I'm not gonna lie, it was a bit of a risk deciding to make a podcast about her. However, we also have a famous example of such a person, one of her contemporaries and allegedly one of her closest friends through written accounts of others, namely the ancient philosophers Plato and Xenophon. We know of one of history's most infamous philosophers, Socrates, who also didn't write anything, yet manages to have such a profound influence on Western thought. So, frankly, at the very least, if we can be bothered to know about him, we can be bothered to know about her. After all, we can't always look at history through writing, but that doesn't mean we can't look at history at all. So, with that being said, we can move on to the history, and we can take a look at Aspasia's origins. From historical records, she was born in Miletus, in Ionia, what would now be Turkey, and she moves to Athens in around 450 BC, where she would begin an affair with another important figure, Pericles. History recognizes him as one of the most powerful statesmen and orators of Athens during its golden age. At this time, Pericles is already married to an Athenian woman, but eventually meets Aspasia, whom Pericles is absolutely smitten by, and divorces his wife. Unfortunately, some years earlier, he himself brought in a citizenship law that entailed that Athenian citizens, like himself, can only marry other Athenian citizens, a brilliant example of a self-inflicted cockblock. Nevertheless, they remain together outside of wedlock, with him being her kyrios, her guardian of sorts, eventually earning Aspasia the title of being the Great Mistress. Her origins only furthered that reputation, as during her time in Athens, Aspasia remained something called a metic, a foreign resident or outsider, almost like a parallel to her relationships with both Pericles and the city of Athens itself. Now, during her time in Athens, Aspasia also became what's known as a hetaira, which is essentially a courtesan. But the heteras weren't your run-of-the-mill prostitutes. In fact, they were the most elite kind of prostitute, and they were highly regarded in Athens as being professional, high-class entertainers who were well-educated, having independence, and fulfilling civic functions like paying taxes. Think of philosophy graduates, but with a side hustle in sex work. These heteras were actually the paradigm example of the liberated woman in ancient history. Wives in Athens seemed to fulfill a strictly functional role, and while they enjoyed civic protections, the heteras were said to be the more entertaining companion to a man than his wife could ever be. Wives were essentially confined to their homes, but Aspasia and the heteras weren't bound by these traditional familial restraints at all. And, taking all of that into consideration, Aspasia is said to be the best of these heteras, i.e., the best of the best, as one would say. And she also had some civic protections just by being around someone as important as Pericles, so we can already infer just how influential she was in ancient Athenian culture. As much as she was influential, however, this didn't mean that she and Pericles were immune from public disfavor. Her relationship with Pericles and her political influence was seen as a threat by a handful of Athenians, and that reputation grew worse when the Samian War broke out around 440 BC. It was basically a war between Athens and another city-state, Samos. After Athens intervened in a previous dispute between Samos and Aspasia's home city-state, Miletus. So, because of that, people blamed Aspasia for having Pericles initiate a campaign against Samos, and that he only did that to basically please her, one of history's earliest simps. It didn't help that the Athenians also sustained heavy losses before they defeated Samos, so there was a sort of unabated distrust that was being put on Aspasia. Some years later, at the precipice of the Peloponnesian War, many prominent figures, including Pericles and Aspasia, faced a barrage of personal and legal attacks. Aspasia herself was accused of asebeia, of impiety. Interestingly, the exact same thing of which Socrates is accused, convicted, and made to commit suicide for. It seems that the Athenians were a little bit trigger-happy on the charge of impiety whenever there was someone that annoyed them a little too much. There are many different accounts of her being discharged from the dispute. like one about the unlikeliness of non-Athenian women, like Aspasia, ever being tried for these sorts of things. But the one account I've found particularly hilarious the most is that she basically turns up and just cries really hard in court until they let her go. Guess she was still more popular than unpopular. Now, keep in mind, all of the information we've said thus far aren't direct accounts. All we have are references in historical and philosophical works of other people. Again, like Socrates, we hear about her from Plato and a little bit from Xenophon as well. In Plato, she's referred to in his dialogue, in the Menexenus, and Socrates is talking to one of his interlocutors, Menexenus, the namesake of the dialogue. In conversation with him, Socrates says about himself that he's basically amazing at talking, owing to his rhetoric teacher who surpasses even himself. He claims that this rhetorician also taught others like Pericles, and Menexenus basically questions Socrates as to who he's referring to, and he comes to the realization that he means none other than Aspasia. The problem, though, with these Platonic dialogues is that they're very dubious in some sense. We don't know if they're flippant jokes or if Plato or Socrates were being serious. As in, we don't know whether Plato is referencing to Socrates' wholehearted affirmation of Aspasia, or if it's ironic and is trying to say that Aspasia's gotten too big for her boots because she's always telling people how to give proper speeches. Or if there's some subliminal message here that behind a talented man, there's a more talented woman. It's just impossible to tell and it's open to interpretation. They do, however, acknowledge that she gives great funeral orations, so that's something. This leads some modern scholars to think that Plato's actually attributing original authorship of the famous funeral oration, not a funeral oration, but rather the funeral oration, to Aspasia instead of Pericles. So, the funeral oration is basically this legendary speech given by Pericles by the end of the first year of the Peloponnesian War, talking about the diseased Athenians, the casualties they lost. It is perhaps the one thing that Pericles is known most for. Early historians like Thucydides basically cement Pericles as this glorious figurehead because of the speech. But the implication here is that Aspasia is the one that wrote the speech. So the question we should all be asking ourselves, at least a bit, is Aspasia and Pericles an early model of Remington Steele, in which she does all the hard work and he takes all the credit? We'll never know. It's worth bearing in mind that in the whole of Plato, in all his extant works, only two women ever speak. The first is Diotima, who nowadays contemporaries believe to be an almost certainly fictional character. The only other woman who talks in all of Plato is, of course, Aspasia herself, so that gives us an idea of how important she must have been. There were actually many dialogues that bore her name that are now sadly lost, but we have other accounts that don't seem to be caricatures of Aspasia. We have Xenophon, who also mentions Aspasia twice in his writings. Both times we see him writing about Socrates as suggesting that his interlocutors go to her for advice. In one of Xenophon's dialogues, Socrates defers to Aspasia as more knowledgeable about things like household management and the economic partnership between a husband and wife. Here, they're a little more clear-cut than the Platonic dialogues, and we can see more of an unimpeded vision of Aspasia. The other sources that we have of Aspasia are, unfortunately, among the comic playwrights. And I say this very pessimistically because the comedians are merciless about people when it comes to who they mention in their works. To invoke Socrates again, the comic playwright Aristophanes, parodying Socrates, makes him an absolute madman, a money-obsessed venal madman. And yet, they were friends. They appear together in the symposium. They even drink together. But surely, all we know is that Aristophanes found Socrates funny and therefore made jokes about him. It's the framework we have to put ourselves in and bear in mind when we look at these sources about Aspasia, but nonetheless, they are vicious about her. One of the early playwrights in political comedy, Cratinus, labels Aspasia a dog-eyed whore, so very constructive criticism there. Aristophanes basically blames Aspasia for the Peloponnesian War. He claimed that the Megarian Decree, a sanction by Athens of the city-state of Megara that excluded it from trade, was basically retaliation for prostitutes being kidnapped from among Aspasia's group by the Megarians. we arrive at the question of why Aspasia keeps turning up, at least more than most women, in the works of so many philosophers and comedians. Modern scholars actually suggest that it was a tradition to get at men through their women. That is, using Aspasia's reputation as a way of attacking Pericles in virtue of the company he's choosing. And this isn't a practice that's long forgotten. Even today, we still see women being used as a metric for men. Aspasia is one of our earliest examples of that. Plato and Xenophon may have given accurate depictions of her, but the comedians may have, through Aspasia, given a criticization of Pericles. We have real-life examples of that in modern figures and their spouses. Perhaps the most famous in a Canadian context is that of Pierre Elliott Trudeau and his wife, Margaret Trudeau. Their high-profile relationship did much to shape PET's reputation among the Canadian political parties. The controversy of her affair with Ted Kennedy is a starting point to the discussion. We see other contemporaries like Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, and their dissociation from the royal family, and backlash of their British opinion against Meghan as a way of questioning Prince Harry's decisions. So we see that studying Aspasia also gives us an insight as to how wives or partners can be seen as extensions of their husband's politics and power, like a limb or an appendage rather than a person themselves. At the heart of the issue is this. In contrast to the many political parties, members, and advisors, all of which are within the public sphere and in the limelight with their relation to the political figure, generally made known, their relationship with their partner is not. There is speculation to be had amongst that relationship, and unlike the political body, the partner's role in the figure's life is unclear. There's always speculation as to a sort of behind-the-scenes influence their partner may have on them. This in turn leads to a lot of comments being made to try and contain that speculation. The purpose of comedy here is a means to contain something which we don't know the measure of, namely the influence of their partner. Essentially, comedy allowed people to gossip without repercussion, and now we have a more clear-cut, direct version of that, namely broadcasted news. With all that being said, while Aspasia's reputation as a philosopher and rhetorician is mostly anecdotal, at the end of the day, we give more credence to the mentions of Aspasia in works outside of comedy. Both Plato and Xenophon give us some substance to work with regarding matters of fact concerning her, but others, opposite to the comedic playwrights, have praised Aspasia in antiquity. Among her assessors are Plutarch, a well-known ancient biographer after Aspasia's time, who commented of her that she brought about an intellectual center in Athens, attracting the most prominent writers and thinkers, among them Socrates, as we've mentioned time and time again. Plutarch accepts her as a significant figure, both politically and intellectually, expressing his admiration for her as a woman who managed as she pleased the foremost men of the state and afforded the philosophers occasion to discuss her in exalted terms and at great length. Yet, there's still concern as to the truth of Aspasia's life. We have figures like Thucydides who don't mention her, our only remaining sources, the untrustworthy representations and speculations recorded by men who either spoke little of her, failing to grasp her as a whole, or by those who ridiculed or worshipped her, turning her into a caricature. In all cases, it seems none of these can be a safe measure to speak of Aspasia as a historical character, and it's the reason why modern scholars express skepticism about the historicity of her life. Still, this doesn't mean all is lost. Even if we can't consider Aspasia as a certifiable historical figure, we can instead look at what she represents, a beautiful, independent, brilliantly witty young woman capable of holding her own in conversation with the best minds in Greece, and illuminating any kind of question. Lucian of Samosata, an ancient Syrian satirist, spoke of her, or at the very least what she represented, as a bastion of political knowledge and insight, and the very model of wisdom. These representations no doubt persuaded contemporary feminist artist Judy Chicago in her art installation, The Dinner Party, as representative of these set of characteristics in women. This triangular table has at each wing a table for a woman or group of women throughout history and mythology, from the ancients all the way to the 20th century, totaling 39 women, not counting the names of the other 998 women inscribed on the floor beneath the table. One of these tables seats Aspasia among the 39 primary. In her place setting, Aspasia is represented through elements commonly found in the art of ancient Greece. Her plate shows a blooming floral pattern suggestive of her femininity and done in earth tones used in the art and architecture of 5th century BC. Taking everything into account, Lucian recognizes that history has not been so kind to the way Aspasia and other prominent women as a whole have been conveyed. He acknowledges that what we know of Aspasia are sorely missed, but in the little amount of information we have, we ought to think of what she was able to accomplish and who she became as a hallmark for just how truly great she was in her life as a whole. He says of her that Aspasia is only preserved to us in miniature. Our proportions must be those of a colossus. And no doubt, Judy Chicago recognizes the need for that colossal proportion in cementing Aspasia's seat at the dinner party among the other 39 great women, forever as number 11.